I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Baltimore's homicide count for 2015 is up to 261, 11 just this week. We speak to a community activist about how West Baltimore neighborhoods are responding to the gun violence and ask the executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association about nationwide homicide trends. Then a look at changes to the Charm City Circulators route. And we talk SAT scores and economic disparity with Timothy Sandoval of the Baltimore Business Journal. We'll also discuss the results of a recent poll of Maryland residents. How do Marylanders feel about legalizing marijuana? How do they view relations between the police and the community? Plus a preview of a short film playing this weekend at the Baltimore International Black Film Festival. All that on Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're joining us for our Friday news roundup. On Tuesday, Baltimore City's free bus system, the Charm City Circulator, added more than 30 blocks combined north and south to its purple route, the circulator route with the most passenger riders. Until this week, the northernmost point of the purple route was Penn Station. Now it reaches all the way to 33rd Street in Charles Village. It's been reported that the circulator has been operating under a deficit since 2010, and that deficit could expand to $73 million over the next decade. So we'd like to know what additional resources the circulator had to generate to make this possible, this expansion, and whether this was the right time to expand it. Joining me now is Kirby Fowler, president of the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore, who played a big role in the creation of the circulator. I'm glad you're here.
Good afternoon.
We know that the circulator right now is operating at a deficit. How much money does it receive from the parking tax annually, and is that the core of its revenue source?
Yeah, the circulator was created based upon a surcharge and a tax that was increased for parking garages. And so in 2009, we went to the city council and we were able to successfully advocate for a 5% increase in the parking tax in order to support the circulator, which generates about $6 million per year.
Okay. And how much additional resources will this expansion cost?
Well, it's unclear. If one additional bus is added to make the extension, one bus costs about $500,000 per year. Now, I'm not as conversant in the dollar figures exactly.
You're not operating.
Right.
Right.
However, I know it's about $500,000 just for one bus, and that includes, you know, upkeep and beyond. So, of course, the city always has to be careful about its use of resources, but transit is such an important social good. We don't ask whether garbage collection or policing, whether or not there's fare recovery associated with that or recovery from citizens. And I just think it's unfair that transit riders have to somehow prove that the system is making money in order for it to continue.
Well, but I mean, of course, as you know, the public bus system, the MTA, there's, I don't want to misquote the percentage of fare recovery, the percentage of operating costs that are supposed to be recovered in fares, but it's set, if not in law, in policy,
right.
And that's certainly a goal. So here we have, you know, a system that is free to riders.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've been curious about is whether is there pushback from the MTA? Is it seen as unfair competition to the established, large, regional bus system to have this literally free riders sort of in the heart of the city?
Yeah, we had the same question back in about 2009, but when we sat down with MTA, I was actually surprised that they were very supportive, and they were basically saying more transit is better. The more transit is better for the entire city. So they've been very supportive, and plus they believe if more people give up cars, then even if a circulator doesn't pass by, an MTA bus might pass by and someone might get on that bus, even if they pay $1.65, $1.70, you know, it might increase their ridership.
Oh, so it could actually kind of be a loss leader for the MTA.
Yeah, and a few years after the circulator service began, I asked someone at MTA, and they saw no difference in ridership. So we did not see a decrease with the MTA ridership.
All right. There aren't many cities that have this kind of free circulator service, are there?
Actually, you'd be surprised. I did a quick check before coming here, but downtown Denver has a free service. Downtown Oakland has a free service. Even Silver Spring has a free service. And on and on. Chattanooga. It's actually I think, the wave of the future. In fact, there's a city in France called Châteauneuf that put its entire city service on a free fare basis, and the city just took off as a result. And other cities in France are following suit. It's just the wave of the future, in my opinion.
So how can this be when it's free? It's not bringing in revenues. It surprises me to hear that it could be the wave of the future.
Well, there's so much social good that's associated with transit riding. First of all, it reduces congestion. It reduces environmental issues. It actually gets people out of cars, so it might reduce obesity as well, and also increase economic development activity. We've seen more residents moving in. And yes, there's many reasons for residents to move in, but 40% of the downtown residents say they've left their cars behind. So we're seeing this trend happening, and the best way to really connect to neighborhoods is through transit.
I'm sorry, 40% of downtown residents, because of the circulator or just in general, when they decide to live downtown?
They have left their cars behind, but we've seen an increase ever since the circulator came on board. We've seen a doubling of the percentage of people who are leaving cars behind or not having cars at all in downtown because they're reliant on this service and also on MTA.
So do you know what particular reasoning went into the decision to expand the Purple Route?
Well,
why the Purple Route and why expand it?
Well, it's aside from the deficit issue, which I think was mostly due to the city buying buses up front when they could have leased them out over several years. But there's a lot of interest in the bus system. It's a very clean, good-looking bus. It's actually a very social type of experience on the bus. It has a diverse ridership. And I think people they want that kind of diverse ridership. And so I think there's been a lot of pull for other neighborhoods to have this. But it was created to reduce congestion downtown. And we could run a tremendous service with $6 million, but it's been expanded beyond that.
Right. And that's what I was trying to understand is what I understand you don't run the Charm City Circulator, but I figure you're sort of aware of the conversations.
Yes,
and I was curious as to if there was any thought of expansion, why was the decision to push north to make it the Purple Route that would expand, and why do it now?
Well, I believe because the Purple Route is the most successful route, and they just saw that there'd be increased ridership. The city did its research in terms of whether or not they could draw more people off the Purple Route if it extended further. They weren't so sure they could increase ridership if they extended the other routes out as far. So they saw the possibility of increased ridership, but also you have these assets up Charles Street, Johns Hopkins in particular, to connect the Johns Hopkins students and others into the core downtown.
So you think this was the right time to do the expansion?
Well, I think the circulator should be expanded as much as possible. My one view is the city, if they are only dependent on the parking tax increase, the $6 million per year, we cannot extend. But I think it's really important for the city to use general fund dollars to expand the service wherever it can be expanded. But the city has to make decisions about what other things they cannot support financially as a result of this.
Timothy Sandoval of the Baltimore Business Journal is here with us as well. Welcome to the show, Timothy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I'm just wondering, the BBJ has covered the circulator as well. Is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. I think, the big question is how's the city going to pay for this? And, you know, obviously we covered some of the issues concerning the deficit that, the route has run over a few years since it's been in place. I think there are obvious benefits, but I think, you know, when people tend to look at this issue or sort of look at, the media covers it, they just look at the numbers, the hard numbers as far as is this solvent? Is this going to remain solvent? And it's hard to always calculate some of the other benefits. So I mean, Kirby obviously explained what some of those are. And I think anecdotally, we've, heard some people who obviously are going to be able to get to work because of this, or, obviously Hopkins students may be connected to Fed Hill, which is obviously a very popular area for young people. So, whether or not we're going to see some, increased traffic down there is another question. So it's, I think some of those things have to be considered as well as just the hard numbers. So.
And can I add one thing about ridership? There's a misnomer that this is only catering to downtown residents. 50% of the riders earn under $45,000, and 31% earn under $21,000. And in terms of the diversity of the riderships in terms of race, 55% of the riders are non-white. So this is a very diverse ridership. This is what we should be striving for. And I don't think you see that on other modes as well.
I appreciate it. That's Kirby Fowler of the Downtown Partnership. Timothy Sandoval, you wrote last week's cover story about SAT scores in Maryland and what they tell us about economic disparity. Tell us about what you found.
Well, essentially, you know, after April's unrest, I think as the Business Journal, we wanted to look into inequality because that was obviously an issue that had come up, had been commented on, talked about, and was sort of the backdrop for, I think, a lot of what was happening in the city at the time and what some of the things that, you know, factors that led to the riots and some of the unrest. So we do a list each year of the top schools, so the schools that score the highest, the top 50 schools. We wanted to add a little bit more depth to that this year. We thought, let's look into some of the underlying factors that may be evident when, you know, looking at SAT scores. Income is a pretty obvious one. So what we did was we took all of the scores, right? So we took every school in Maryland, look at their average score. We added another column to this to the data set that we had, which was the number of students who were free or reduced priced meals, mm-hmm. which essentially would mean that they have they're low income mm-hmm. students, so they're students who may be impoverished essentially. So if you have a high percentage of that at a school, that means that there are essentially a lot of low income students. So we looked at that and compared that, and actually had a professor at the University of Maryland kind of run an analysis on this. And what he found was that the more students that are the more low income students you have at a school, the worse they do on the SAT. So 42% is about the average for farm students, which are free and reduced price lunch students at a school. For every 10% you add to that, scores tend to drop by 90 points. So that was the finding of his analysis. And we kind of looked at that and talked to some other folks as to why that might be. Obviously, poverty is linked to a lot of things. A lot of, you perhaps had a lack of good resources as far as parents who read to you, right? And you, some of the things that we think about that are associated with low income often. So.
Right. I mean, as you said, you used the phrase "pretty obvious" when you described the connection between income and test scores in general, not necessarily SAT scores in particular. What surprised you as you were doing this research? What was it that you thought this I did not expect?
Right. Well, what I think is interesting is the acknowledgement of that. More today, I think you know, the city is going to be looking at a program right now, or you know, raising funds right now, and is looking to get some publicity and such for a program called Say Yes to Education, which basically would provide scholarships to all students who graduate from Baltimore City to go to public universities in the state of Maryland. Or get scholarships. Some other private colleges would participate in this as well. Part of that is also streamlining and making more efficient programs which are aimed at reducing the barriers for Baltimore City schools, particularly low-income students, you know, things that might affect them, you know, in terms of mental health counseling they may need, other things like, even legal counseling that their family may need if they're being, I don't know, screwed over by a landlord or something like that. So just more acknowledgement of that. Yeah. And most of the education experts that I spoke to today, they really understand that this is a big problem. So yeah. And obviously now that city leaders are looking at this program, we see that there is acknowledgement of that and that needs to be addressed.
I'd like to quickly move to another education related story. The Baltimore Business Journal did this week. Laureate Education Incorporated, which is a Baltimore based company that operates for profit colleges around the world, is going public.
That's right.
Earlier this month, they filed for an initial public offering. Which was accompanied by the disclosure that the company carries $4.7 billion in debt. This is an important company in Baltimore. It's not that high profile. Just briefly tell me what we should know about it.
Yeah, and well, it's interesting that you say it's not that high profile. I think the reason it's not necessarily as well known as other for-profit higher education companies is because most of the students that it serves are outside of the United States. So 95%, most of them are in Latin America. So we don't hear as much about them, I think, because of that, or perhaps don't know as much about them. But yeah, like you said, the debt is an issue, I think, for investors to look at. If people are looking at investing in this company or you know, putting some money behind it. $4.7 million in total debt as of June.
Billion.
Billion. That's correct. Yes. You know, so yeah, that's something to look at.
But their revenues were about $4.4 billion.
Revenues about $4.4 billion. So yeah, they have
grown. Really that heavy a debt load for if it's a growing company?
You know, that would be something for an analyst to speak about.
Sure.
I think for sure. You know, it's something to look at. I think, you know, if you look at like you said, $4.4 billion in revenue, you know, isn't bad. I mean, that's increased since 2010. So yeah, it's definitely something to look at for an investor.
And just quickly, because we are running out of time, but today's cover story in the Baltimore Business Journal is about the city zoning code.
Yes, it's about the city zoning code. So we haven't updated the city zoning since 1971.
It's a long time.
It's a very long time. Richard Nixon was president at the time, and the Bee Gees were on the radio at the time. So it's been quite a while.
So
right. So it's very, you know, I guess the issue there, you know, briefly, is that there's really no way in 1971 that they could have imagined the kind of businesses that want to grow here in or start here in Baltimore. You know, who would have known that in 1971 that something that's zoned industrial or that was a factory then would now be this kind of swanky coffee shop or restaurant or something like that.
It seems like this rezoning has been going on for a long time. Is the end in sight?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a city councilman, Jim Kraft, said that they hope to have the legislation finalized by January, so it would go into effect in mid-2016. No guarantee on that, though. Nobody knows how that's going to move forward. And it's difficult, you know, because whenever you run into these zoning issues, you get a lot of residents who kind of get upset about new businesses or things like that, where it's like, you know, not in my backyard, and that's, to use a cliche. But, you know, that's an issue, and that's what council people have to deal with when, you know, these new kind of proposals are being made.
Kirby Fowler, you've been sitting closely with us. Is there anything that you want, as a downtown business partnership, want to make a quick point about the new zoning, the revision of the zoning ordinance?
Yeah, I think it's long overdue. We've worked with the city plan department for quite some time on it. But I agree, we need to find new ways to accommodate these new uses. It's not just coffee shops. There's artists who want to live and work in their same space. And before, zoning would separate all these uses. And it's a really bad thing for a city to have residential in one area or industrial in one. Yeah, you have dead zones. And so this helps to create this mixed-use community that we all need.
I appreciate you both being with us. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks.
Kirby Fowler of the Downtown Business Partnership and Timothy Sandoval, researcher and reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. Thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Malaya Cromer of Goucher College joins us to talk about poll results that show support for Governor Hogan crosses party lines. And we spoke with the director behind a short film playing this weekend, part of the Baltimore International Black Film Festival. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Governor Hogan's approval numbers are up. More Marylanders are optimistic about the state's future, and the state's residents are divided about the idea of legalizing marijuana. Malaya Cromer is a political scientist at Goucher College and director of the school's Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center, which conducts the Goucher Poll, a survey of citizens across the state. And Malaya Cromer is on the phone. Welcome back to Midday, Malaya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're glad you could join us. Talk to us about Governor Hogan's approval ratings.
So this is the second time we've asked about Governor Hogan's approval ratings. The first time was back in February when he was just a month on the job. And what it looks like is he has a lot of support across a large cross-section of Maryland residents. So his approval ratings are tracking right around 58%, just a shade under 60. And this support is really consistent across most demographic groups, and particularly across that party divide, which is really important. He's at 54% among Democrats right now.
Uh-huh. 54% among Democrats, and among Republicans, much higher than that.
It's 80% among Republicans, so I think that Republicans are really, really pleased with the governor right now.
Is there anything you can tell from the poll about what the factors are, what people are pointing to as they judge his performance?
I think the big thing is the direction of the state. And so this bump in direction of the state has also a lot to do with how pleased Republicans are with the direction of the state. So we've asked about this, the direction of the state, every single time we put out a Goucher poll. And there is a 20-point increase from the last time we asked about it in September 2014 until now. And if you start to break up that number by party ID, you will see that a lot more Republicans overwhelmingly are really happy with the direction of the state. And Democrats are, too. So it's not, and it's that, and it's also Hogan's doing well across the kind of key policy issues, the things that he ran on, economic growth and development and taxes. The majority of Marylanders support the way he's handling those statewide issues.
A majority of Marylanders of both parties.
Of both parties, exactly.
And you mentioned that in terms of the overall approval of the direction the state is going, that was true, very true among Republicans, but also true among Democrats. Break that down for us. How much more pleased about the direction of the state are Democrats in your latest poll compared to the way they felt, the Democrats felt, nearing the end of the O'Malley administration last fall?
Now, Democrats were still more happier with the direction of the state back in September than Republicans were. That really big jump in being happy about the direction of the state really comes more so through the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. So right now, 64% of registered Republicans think the state is going in the right direction. If you dial that back till September 14, I believe it was in the low, like around the 30s. So there's a really huge jump between Republicans, how happy they are with the direction of the state between back in September and now.
And less of an increase.
It's less of an increase among Democrats.
But still some.
But still something. So in general, if you ask the right track, wrong direction, 57% of Democrats think the state is going in the right direction.
And do you have any insights? You said, if I'm following your numbers correctly,
mm-hmm.
It's something like a third of Republicans are not happy with the direction of the state.
So, yes. So around 34% think the state is going on the wrong track and versus 32% of Democrats.
Hmm. And by the way, when was this poll conducted?
So we were in the field from September 26th until October 1st.
Uh-huh.
We interviewed 636 Marylanders from a random sample, both cell phones and landlines, and that gives us a plus or minus about 3.9% in terms of margin of error.
You ask about legalization of marijuana. Of course, Maryland has a medical marijuana industry getting off the ground. What are Marylanders saying about what was the question you asked about legalization?
We asked if they supported or opposed making the use of marijuana legal here in Maryland. And so we've asked this since October 13. And over the past four cycles that we've asked about it, it has maintained a consistent right around 52%. And this actually tracks really closely with what we see nationwide when this same question is asked to nationwide U.S. citizens.
Hmm. So that's just not moving.
It's just not moving. And so that it's interesting how it has reached this peak and how it kind of has leveled off. And I think a lot of people in Maryland and really all over the country are kind of waiting and seeing how well the legalization of marijuana has taken place in states like Colorado and Washington. So what their tax base looks like, if there has been any issues in regard to crime related to drugs. And those types of things, I think that right now everybody's sort of just waiting and seeing to see what happens. What's interesting is we did follow up with residents, and we asked them if the laws regarding marijuana should be determined by the federal government or the states. What's really interesting is 64% of Maryland residents want to see the states decide marijuana policy, not the federal government.
Hmm. That's interesting. Another issue you asked about, certainly one that's been in the headlines in Baltimore, but elsewhere, really the similar to the issue we talked about at the beginning of this hour, police and community relations. What did you ask and what did you find?
So we asked several different indicators about policing and community relations. We asked our respondents whether they disagreed or agreed with each of the following statements. And I think when we think about the larger context of the issue surrounding the Freddie Gray trial, and what are some sort of solutions for communities to actually address the relationship between the police and the people that they serve, around 61% of Maryland residents would like to see a situation where the community's police department looks racially similar to the people who are living in that community. They also would like to see 51%, a small majority, would like to see police officers living in the communities in which they serve. And those are two things that criminologists sometimes point to as solutions to some of these policing problems.
Did you get different responses from the different races?
Absolutely. So this is where you see the issue that divides Black Marylanders from white Marylanders. So when we ask that same question, right, so about police should be matching the community demographics, 66% of Black respondents say yes, I agree with that, they should match the community demographics versus 57% of white respondents. And in terms of living in the community, only 44% of white respondents agree versus 59% of African-American respondents. So you can see those in terms of the policy solutions. There are divisions among different racial demographics.
Mm-hmm. Malaya, when is your next poll going to be done?
So we will be back in the field with our legislative issues poll, I believe the last week in February. So we'll be releasing sometime in early March. We try to get right in the middle of the legislative session.
Uh-huh. So it's not just looking ahead to legislative issues. You're going to be asking people after the legislature has started debating some of them.
Absolutely. We try to pick the key ones that the legislature is talking about right in the middle of that legislative session.
And you'll come and talk to us about it?
Well, I would love to. That would be fantastic.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Malaya Cromer. She is a political science at Goucher College, director of the school's Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center, which conducts the Goucher poll. And now we turn to a local event this weekend, the Baltimore International Black Film Festival. Films from 16 nations will be shown at the Charles Theater at the University of Baltimore Learning Commons. The festival... Charles Theater and at the University of Baltimore Learning Commons. The festival began on Wednesday, but there's still time to catch a lot of the offerings. The festival runs through Monday, October 12th. And with me in the studio is filmmaker Manda Raquel Webb from Silver Spring. She is the woman behind a short film that follows two young girls at the 1958 World's Fair in Brussels, Belgium. Manda, welcome to
Hi,
Midday.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about your film. Why were you focusing on the 1958 World's Fair?
Well, I was trolling Twitter one day, and I ran across a picture of a young girl inside of a fenced-in corral, and she was surrounded by white people that were looking to feed her, and the caption said, African girl being fed like a monkey in a human zoo, and 1958 Brussels. And
1958. So this is not 60 years ago. This is like 50-some years ago.
And I became obsessed. I had never heard of human zoos during my formal education, and the fact that it was 1958. I mean, my parents were 11. I thought about all the things that were going on here in the United States, especially on the civil rights front.
Uh-huh.
And I literally said, you know what, I want to bring this story to life. I want to think about it from the point of view of this African girl. What if this were her first day as a human curiosity in a human zoo where people paid, purportedly over a billion people paid to see human curiosities throughout the history of human zoos. So
uh-huh.
I wanted to just kind of look at it from her perspective and what she may have been feeling on that day.
So how do you approach making a film about something that happened? I imagine there was some documentary footage that existed.
There is. I mean, thank goodness for the internet and Google and YouTube. Primarily, the premise was that here was this African girl in a zoo. And she has no name. There were only two that I understand documented photographers there that just basically took the photo. So, but the history of human zoos, I looked at videos in French. I looked at videos in German and tried and figured out the best I could to extract some of the information from it. And, you know, they say that pictures are worth 1,000 words. So I'm glad there were some videos to talk about this. And there weren't just Africans. There were several other nationalities that were on display in human zoos. But Africans were used, this is like right before imperialism began and were used as a measuring stick.
Right. Sorry. You said this is before imperialism began or this was, this was during the
this
period
was during,
of
correct,
colonialism?
Late 19th and early 20th centuries. So they, Europeans were looking at Africans as less than, as uh-huh. monkeys, and would compare them as such.
Uh-huh.
So they, the treatment was, being in a human zoo was had more of an effect than the Native Americans or the bearded people or the Asians.
So were you able to find the identity of the girl at the Brussels World Fair? Do you, what were you able to learn about her and tell us about her?
Absolutely nothing. I don't know her name. And that was very troubling to me. So when I wrote the script, all of the characters in the script do not have names. They are just referred to as German girl or German mother or African girl, African mother. It would be great. She could possibly still be living.
Oh, my goodness. I had not thought of that. Mm-hmm. She was how old?
Hard to tell. I don't know. Happy to show you the photo.
We will find a way to put that on the midday website.
So
just tell us a bit more about your film. Is how long?
11 minutes.
And it is titled
Zoo Volker Show, and the Volker Show is German for human zoo or look show, literally translated.
And where was it filmed?
In my backyard in Rockville, Maryland.
And when can people see it?
They can see it tomorrow at 2 o'clock p.m. at the University of Baltimore Learning Commons, located at 1415 Maryland Avenue, right here in Baltimore.
What kind of, have you shown this film elsewhere?
Yes. We've been on the film circuit since January, actually. And the response has been phenomenal, and primarily from an educational standpoint, most people are just blown away that they didn't know about human zoos. And for me, I look at it as if we can, the purity that a child looks at life, if we as adults can capture some of that purity and just see one another as human, then the world would be a better place.
Yeah, so. It is a big message. I really appreciate your telling us about it. Just very briefly, what kind of response are you getting to the film?
Awesome response. People want to see it made into a film. And you know what? So would we. My producer, Sabrina Gray, and I would love to see it made into a film, but we would just need to secure financing and develop the script for it.
Manda, thank you.
Thank you.
Manda Raquel Webb, producer, director, screenwriter. I really appreciate your being with us today. For details about all the films available this weekend, check out BIBFF.com, BIBFF.com. We'll link to that from our website. Thank you for listening. Lunch on Fridays provided by Joe Squared. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. For locations and hours, visit JoeSquared.com. We'll be back Monday when we'll take a look at the chronic absenteeism in Maryland schools. What's keeping kids from attending class? How can schools hang on to students who are farthest out of reach? Stay tuned now for Here and Now. I'm Sheila Clast. I'm glad you've been with us. Come back on Monday.